Welcome to the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota. This is Arts and Cultural Heritage producer Jeff Carmack. And in today's Untold Story, I'm sitting down once again with SCSU Ethnic Studies professor Christopher Lehman. In past interviews with Professor Lehman, we've chatted about his book, Slavery in the Upper Mississippi Valley, and also his efforts, which proved successful, to rename SCSU's Building 51 after the first African-American graduate of the college, Ruby Cora Webster. Today, we're going to be talking about a couple of different things he's got happening, including a new book he's got coming out through the Minnesota Historical Society Press this fall about the history of slavery in Minnesota. And he'll also be at Jules Bistro this Wednesday, June 26th at 5:30 p.m. for SCSU's College of the Liberal Arts Anna Branch program, where faculty from the school give a short presentation and take questions from the audience about their current academic projects and how these projects are having an impact upon the greater community. Welcome, Christopher, to the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota today. We've got a couple of neat things that you got going on. And, which would you like to talk about first, your new book coming out or your presentation with Anna Branch?
Well, I'll talk about the Anna Branch presentation since that's coming up first on June 26th, I think so,
yep.
At Jules Bistro. So I'll be talking about an article I wrote that's coming out in Minnesota History Magazine next month. And the article is about the African-American community that existed in St. Cloud about a century ago. The article is, I think, going to be titled Black Cloud. It's sort of a play on the white cloud reputation that St. Cloud has. And I've lived here for 17 years, and as long as I've lived here, I've heard about the white cloud reputation, and I've always wanted to try to get to the root of that. Why are we called that?
I've heard that too.
Right. And why has that stuck? And over the years, I've learned about how the town was divided in thirds and how the northern third was where slaveholders invested in land, and the central third was where a lot of immigrants, especially from Germany, settled. And then the lower third, where we are, is where the liberals from the East Coast came and started the university and so forth. And as I looked at the African-American community that came here, it was largely in the 1880s when they stayed. Before then, there were the slaves who came with the slaveholders in the 1850s. But when the Civil War broke out, the African-Americans left with the slaveholders. And after the 1860s, there were people who sort of came and went, and there was never an African-American population that was consistent until about 1883, when the Lee family from Kentucky came over. And then after that, a few years later, the Webster family, also originally from Kentucky and Ohio, came over. And it's through the Lee family and the Webster family that the African-American community of St. Cloud from 100 years ago has its foundation. And what I learned in writing the article for next month is that it was a pretty stable community. It allowed the African-American population to go from the single digits to the double digits by the time you get to around 1900. There was, I think, another family that came along, and they stayed for about 5 years. They were the Bassfield family out of Iowa. And the major recruiter for African Americans was a man named Josiah Hayward, who ran a local hotel, the West Hotel, and I think later the Grand Central Hotel. And he was the only person in town who was hiring African Americans. Otherwise, there would be nothing for African Americans to do when they came here. The people who ran farms were self-sufficient because they would just have their children operate the farms with them. So there was
the large families and everything.
Yes, yep. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So there was never this push in St. Cloud for the hiring of a lot of ex-slaves because their background in agriculture wouldn't be needed.
Yeah, the contrast where I grew up is Waterloo, Iowa, and John Deere is there. It's a it's a city in Iowa. It's an industrial city right in the middle of agriculture, and there was there's a very large African American population there because people came there to work. They would hire. There was that industry, so I can see that contrast. Well, there's nothing to do. They're not going to come.
Right.
Yeah.
So the population stays small because the Hayward family is the only family that's inviting people here. But that population is able to sustain itself for quite a few years. They live largely in the downtown area above different businesses that are downtown at the time. And the kids go to school in the lower third of St. Cloud. And the schools are integrated, or they're integrating the schools, but my point is that there are not white-only and black-only schools in St. Cloud. They're going to school together, and of all the children, Ruby Webster is the one who stays in college in town, and she graduates and becomes the first known African-American alum of the university, which is what Webster Hall is named after.
Exactly.
But what happens with Ruby and with all the other children who are raised in St. Cloud is that there are no job opportunities for them that are consistent with the educational levels that they have. So they all leave. Most of them go to the Twin Cities. And I learned not too long ago that Billy Lee's son, Arthur Lee, is the same Arthur Lee who moved into a neighborhood in Minneapolis and aroused the anger of local European American residents and had to have police protection while he lived there. So Arthur Lee was born and raised in St. Cloud and then went off to Minneapolis and made history there. Oh. Although he didn't probably want to make it that way.
Yeah. Kind of how that happens sometimes.
Right. But the kids left, and eventually the parents died, and as a result, there is no African-American historical family in St. Cloud that dates before 1960. After the Lees leave and the Websters leave or die, there's this small trickle of African-Americans that still come into the hotels or the barber shops and work as barbers. They're overwhelmingly men. I think there's only one woman who moves in, but that's because she's married to one of the people who works as a barber. And the population drops from double digits to single digits. And one of the things that I point out in my article is that this drop is taking place at the same time that there's this great migration from Southern African Americans to cities all over the North and the West. The Twin Cities gets a boost in African-American population, but St. Cloud doesn't. It goes the opposite way. It drops from double to single. And that's because there are no people in St. Cloud who are recruiting African-Americans. And I took a look at different African-American newspapers that were printed in the Twin Cities at the time, from the 1890s to the 1920s, and in African-American newspapers, the city of St. Cloud does not come up, really. The only time it does on a consistent basis is when there's someone who's convicted and sent to the state prison in St. Cloud. So if African-Americans in the Twin Cities aren't promoting St. Cloud except in this negative way, then, of course, African-Americans aren't going to want to go there.
Yeah, why would anyone want to go there? Exactly.
Right. So the African-American community that exists today in St. Cloud that has to do with slave descendants doesn't really take shape until the 1950s when that state prison begins to recruit African Americans from across the country to work there. And at the same time, the baseball team, the St. Cloud Rocks, starts to have at least one African American on their team every year from 1953 onward. And there's also the VA hospital. They start hiring African Americans as well. So by 1960, the numbers begin to rise to double digits again. And then in the 1970s, St. Cloud State University starts hiring a lot more African American faculty and staff as well. And that boosts the numbers even further. So the oldest African American family in St. Cloud, as far as a consistent presence, is not even 60 years yet, really.
Wow. That's intriguing. Yeah. You've got a good way of just explaining this history, right, of this, you know, because this is a complex thing. Mm-hmm. And it can be a touchy topic because it's like, you don't want to say that there's racism going on, but at the same, well, because it's just, there's just nothing going on here. And does that make sense? It's like there might be this, this fear of the other, or the, you know, the problems that other communities are having at this time. Mm-hmm. But there's just nothing here. And that's kind of what I'm hearing, is that there's just this big gap, and there's nobody offering any work, so nobody came up to work. There was an association that this is the prison town, so nobody wants to go there anyways. And, you know, so it just, yeah, so that could be where the white cloud came from.
Oh, there's something else, too. Yeah. The city was very Democrat in its politics, and from the 1850s well into the 1950s and 60s, to be a Democrat was to be in favor of segregation and slavery before that. And I think this heritage that St. Cloud had, politically speaking, comes from the Southern slaveholders having such a financial foothold on the community, because the people who bought land, who were slaveholders, were Democrats because they were slaveholders, and Democrats like slavery. Now, the German immigrants who came here did not come with slaves. They were not interested in slavery. But immigrants generally tend to want to latch on to the people who have the power.
Blend in, basically, right. Yeah.
And since the slaveholders had the power, immigrants tended to side with the Democrat Party. And they at least supported the platform of the Democrat Party in embracing slavery. And after the Civil War begins and the Southerners leave, the immigrants stay Democratic. And St. Cloud just has this overwhelmingly anti-African-American sentiment. It's in the newspapers, even in the German language newspapers that I've read. I've come across the N-word, at least the way it appears in German. Hmm. And there was a report about businesses being segregated in downtown St. Cloud. And there was one person who experienced this and went out of his way to contact the county attorney, who happened to be a lower St. Cloud resident, who had to remind the business that Minnesota had this law that allowed for public accommodations to be integrated, so the restaurant in question could not do that anymore. But that's the kind of thing that happened in St. Cloud just because of the politics of the place. And because St. Cloud is such an isolated city, it was just allowed to go unchecked for a long time.
It's like the tradition just kept rolling, and mm-hmm. Yeah, huh.
Now, to give you a sense of the isolation in St. Cloud, one of the things that I learned that has nothing to do with the African-American community is that in the 1950s, briefly, St. Cloud, as official city policy or law banned some comic books and banned the novel Native Son by Richard Wright. It was against the law for news dealers, booksellers to sell them. This, I think, was from 1950 until 1952 or 53. And the only reason that the law changed was because some reporter in the Twin Cities found out about it and reported it in the Twin Cities paper. And so people from the Twin Cities, I guess, were saying, what's up with St. Cloud banning comic books? So once St. Cloud was exposed that way, then...
But it took like 2 years.
Right. It did take 2 years.
You get any idea which comics were banned? Or because I have not heard that story before.
No, I don't know.
Okay.
And this would have been, I think, before the Comics Code was put in that made comics cleaner. But
yeah, that is a sense of isolation. They did a thing. They banned books. And it took 2 years for somebody to figure it out. It's that rolling tradition. This is how we've done things. This is how we've always done things. This is what we think of this, and we're just going to do this, and we don't have to tell anybody because we're just the ones doing it.
Right.
Is essentially what it sounds like.
Yes.
Oh, wow. Well, so that's going to be Anna Branch. Anna Branch is a partnership with St. Cloud State, and it's essentially, well, the word Anna Branch means it's a part of a river that leaves the river and then comes back and forms a little island. We got a whole bunch of Anna Branches down on the Beaver Islands down there. And that's a partnership where various faculty from SCSU, well, basically go to Jules Bistro and just talk about what you got going on.
And that's Anna Branch at Jules Bistro on Wednesday, June 26th, beginning at 5:30 p.m. So today on the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota, we're talking with Professor Christopher Lehman. And now let's talk about this new book you've got coming out. You've written before, of course, but you've got a new book coming out through the Minnesota Historical Society, and it's a little different this time. You want to give us an idea what the book is?
Certainly. The book is called Slavery's Reach, Southern Slaveholders in the North Star State, and it's coming out October 1st. And this book is different from the previous book that I'd written about slavery in that it's not about the Midwest as a whole, but specifically about Minnesota. And in the previous book, I had tried to find as many instances of slaves living in the Midwest as I could find. But with this new book, I wanted to focus on the slaveholders, and I wanted to focus on the money trail that I found in slaveholders coming from the South to use their money from slave labor to buy real estate. And what I found was that there were quite a few communities throughout Minnesota that developed from this money. St. Cloud is one of them. To an extent, there are neighborhoods in St. Paul and Minneapolis that did as well. The University of Minnesota had a loan through a slaveholder who had 700 slaves and never paid back the loan fully. That's in the book as well. And then there are smaller communities like Big Lake, Shakopee, and several others that also benefited from slaveholders buying land in those communities. And there was a time when Minnesota was a territory, and during the territorial years, Minnesotans could not elect their own governor and lieutenant governor. They had to be appointed by the president. And since presidents appoint people who have similar politics to them, when the country had Democratic presidents in the era of slavery, sometimes they appointed supporters of slavery or just outright slaveholders to offices in Minnesota. And from 1853 to 1857, Minnesota's lieutenant governor, which back then was called the Secretary of the Territory, was a Virginian who held slaves in Virginia. And he may have brought slaves to Minnesota, but he definitely had slaves back in Virginia. His name was J.T. Rosser, and he was known as a flamboyant person and a rather violent person as well. In my research, I found at least two or three articles where he would just get into fights with people who had nasty things to say about the South. But this guy was one heartbeat away from being the governor of Minnesota for 4 years. And he lived in Minnesota for a few years after his term ended. And he went to the South for the Democratic Convention in 1860. And then the following year, when the Civil War broke out, he actually stayed in the South and joined the Confederate Army. So we had an instance of someone who was second in charge of a Union territory now fighting against that Union. We don't hear that much about Minnesota Confederates or Minnesota-based people who joined the Confederacy, but Rosser is one of them. Another one was a very prominent landowner in northern St. Cloud. He was a plantation owner of two plantations, actually, one in Tennessee and one in Mississippi. His name was Robert Carruthers, and after buying thousands of dollars worth of land in St. Cloud, he went back to Tennessee, and in 1863, he was elected the governor of Tennessee. But he was elected as the Confederate governor. So when the Union took over quite a bit of Tennessee, Carruthers was never actually able to be sworn in and inaugurated. But he became governor of Tennessee at the time that he still owned land in St. Cloud. So Minnesota has quite a few examples of active Confederates still holding property in Minnesota.
Huh. And that would explain much,
yes.
Right there. Yeah, yeah. Huh. Intriguing. Yeah, because your other book that we've talked about before, there's just some fascinating things about how the different states would deal with this topic, or the reality. It's not. I don't think the environment of slavery. Mm-hmm. I guess you could say that'd be a little bit more accurate.
Right.
You know, because we talk about it like it's a topic these days, but it's like, well, no, there was something that happened, mm-hmm. and then there are still things that are happening because of the thing that happened.
Right.
And let's try to figure out what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what history is about. Let's look and let's see. And this comes right back into your Anna Branch thing. It's like there are people that owned things here, and there's the philosophy, and it just kind of lingers.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Yeah, the tourism business is really important during this time. Mm-hmm. And there was a brief period after the Dred Scott decision when slavery was legal in Minnesota because Minnesota was a territory, and the Dred Scott decision said that slavery was legal in all territories. But that was only for 14 months, and then Minnesota became a free state, but it had already been really dependent on Southern tourism. So owners of hotels went out of their way to tell Southern guests that Minnesotans would not interfere with any master-slave relationship that they bring to the hotels. That, yeah, Minnesota's a free state, so in a legal sense, if you bring a slave within the borders, then that person is free. But we're not going to do anything to encourage the freedom, and we're not going to go out of our way to try to reach out to any slaves and help them. So they'll probably just go back to the South with you when their vacation is over. And that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, because how are the slaves going to know what the exact situation is? Nobody's telling them. They're not legal scholars. They don't know these things.
Right.
They have no idea. They're just doing what they're told because this is how it is. Mm-hmm. So they had no idea.
Right. Now, there were two people in the state government who actually tried to codify into law this unspoken practice. In 1860, there was a bill that was introduced in the state house and a bill that was introduced in the state senate that would make it legal for Southerners to bring their slaves and have that tourist slavery be legal for 6 months. Both bills failed, fortunately, but there were some Democrats who voted for those bills, and those Democrats happened to be people who had profited quite a bit from slavery. One of them was George Sweet, who is known as the founder of Sauk Rapids. And there were quite a few Southerners who bought his land a few years earlier. So he had a financial stake in voting the way that he did.
I think a lot of that does come back around to money, though, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There you go. There you go. Anything else you got going on? We got the book. We got Anna Branch.
Well, those are about the only things I can think of. I certainly want to take time to thank everyone who was so supportive of the campaign to rename Webster Hall last year. It was a labor of love, and I was just really touched by the support that I received from the campus community. And it means a lot to me. I know that it means a lot to the descendants of Ruby Webster as well.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a lot of, you know, like what we're talking about, you know, these larger issues, eventually it kind of wraps right back around to that. You know, somebody brings something up like, hey, let's do this. Mm-hmm. What's this complex, strange situation? Let's try this. And then people think about it. Well, that does sound like a good idea. Let's mm-hmm. do this. And I think, you know, a lot of it comes back around to that. You know, we can look at a situation and just kind of pick it apart and be like, well, what's going on here? And then somebody comes up with an idea. And if it's a good idea, everyone is like, yeah, let's do that. Mm-hmm. So there we go. Well, thanks for stopping in today, Chris.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed it.
And we've been speaking with SDSU Ethnic Studies Professor Christopher Lehman here on The Untold Stories of Central Minnesota. His book, Slavery's Reach, will be available this fall through the Minnesota Historical Society Press. And once it's available, we'll have a link up on our website at kvsc.org under the podcast Untold Stories of Central Minnesota tab and the page for this story. Christopher Lehman will also be at Jules Bistro this Wednesday, June 26th at 5:30 p.m. for St. Cloud State University's College of Liberal Arts Anna Branch program, where members of SDSU's faculty discuss and take questions about their projects from the public. And a link to that is in our website at kvsc.org under the Area Events tab, as well as the page for the podcast of this story. This has been Arts and Cultural Heritage producer Jeff Carmack, and The Untold Stories of Central Minnesota is made possible through support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. It has been produced at KVSC, a proud member of AMPRS, Diverse Radio for Minnesota's Communities.